beach easy.
I was there. They let me in the room with him when they had him breathing good. But I was sitting there watching him when, as far as I knew, it was the first time he'd really opened his eyes. But he opened his eyes like that. And, of course, he couldn't see anything, I guess. All a blur to him. But he opened his eyes, and I was watching. I mean, you know, he's a big old baby. and his foot twitched. And when his foot twitched, his eyes got big like that. Like, I didn't know I was all that. And the first thing I thought was, he's already everything he's ever going to be is right there. And I started crying. But yeah, that was one of the most powerful things I'd ever seen in my life.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. I'm Julie, and this week I'm talking to Bo Bryan, an author and Myrtle Beach's 2024 Poet Laureate. He's a traveler, a father, and from one of the families that made Myrtle Beach what it is today.
My family goes back three generations here. My grandfather came to Myrtle Beach in 1887 as the general manager of the Burroughs and Collins Combine and built the first iteration of what became Myrtle Beach. It was a little village called Newtown. Mm-hmm. And Granddaddy oversaw the building of the first store, the building of the first pavilion, the building of the railroad. My grandfather ran the town. There was no sheriff. There was no judge. There was no manager but him. He was Mr. Jim. If you had a problem, you took it to him. And he was the final authority. Mm-hmm. And people, they had to sustain themselves. There was no grocery store
right
out here. They hunted and fished. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, there was a 60-mile stretch of white sand beach on a crescent that on the old maps was called Long Bay, and nothing would grow on it. So it seemed to have no value whatsoever.
Isn't that crazy?
Little did anybody know that every running foot of it would turn out to be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars a foot. You know, you grow up here, you watch that value increase and increase and increase.
Bo's daddy played a big part in the growth of Myrtle Beach, and Bo grew up seeing the impact his father had.
Dad was a lawyer, prosecuted war criminals, came back. And the corporate law, small town corporate law practice just was no challenge, or he quit the law all in one day and came out of that and became a real estate developer. The first thing that he developed was a golf course called the Dunes Club. Hmm. He and his brother, Uncle James, got Daddy the land, and Daddy commenced to attract the most famous golf architect of his time, Robert Trent Jones, come down here, and Daddy showed him the land. It was a beautiful piece of land. They called it the Dunes because where the clubhouse of the Dunes Club is now, at one time there was about 100-foot tall sand dune there, with no trees growing on it, and it was gorgeous, and it guarded the north bend of Singleton Swash. It's a huge sand dune. And there were other dunes around it. And then back from that were a system of estuaries and a old-growth, long-leaf yellow pine forest that had some good-sized spreading oaks in it, but mainly it was long-leaf pine, and they were huge. And the land was just, it was rolling hills because they were sand dunes. The Dunes Club is they got grass growing on it now, but it's all sand dunes out there.
Wow.
All those rolling hills are sand dunes.
And that's one of the premier golf courses. Isn't that where they're having the PGA tournament?
It's always been underrated, but it's always counted one of the top 100 golf courses in the country, if not in the world.
In the world, yeah.
Yeah.
It does rank.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece.
Bo is proud of what his father accomplished, but he felt he fell short of his father's expectations. Bo struggled in school, and he struggled to showcase his talents.
I was partially dyslexic, and it was never diagnosed. I just had a lot of trouble reading, and the only way I got through school was I could memorize notes. So I struggled through high school, and when scored so low on the SATs, and I had a low C average, and so my father determined that the best shot I had, and he was just trying to do the best for me, was to put me in a postgraduate year of high school at Severn School in Severna Park, Maryland. So I went away to prep school a year after I graduated from high school. All the rest of my class went on to college or whatever else they did, and I went to a postgraduate year of high school.
Did you feel that was a loving move, or did your dad ever make you feel dumb, or like did he just think you were
He did
slow,
everything. He never criticized me vocally. He never, he was very, very tough on me. And when I would break the rules, he was hard.
But
and I broke the rules with great determination. And, you know, every chance I got, I was just slick and got away with a lot of it.
But so, do you feel like you disappointed him?
Absolutely, yeah. I did disappoint him.
Yeah.
You know?
But he must have known, as far as the reading and the academics went, he must have known that you were not slow just by your presence and your...
I don't know.
But I know they didn't diagnose
dyslexia. I had not found any way to demonstrate that I was other than what I was assumed to be, which was somewhat dull.
Feeling like he couldn't measure up in Myrtle Beach, Bo left for New York City, hoping to find himself and his purpose.
I stayed in New York 4 years. I went over to Barcelona for about 6-8 months and found out I couldn't be a Spaniard. So I came back to New York and stayed on in New York for some time and just loved it. Oh, my God. I never felt like I fit in anywhere around here. In New York City, everybody's a misfit.
Yeah.
I fit right in. I mean, they liked me in New York. They liked the accent, you know. Here I am in New York City, and I'm writing 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And then at night, I was hanging out with big-time journalists. I mean, I got to know the crew at Rolling Stone magazine.
Cool.
And the girl who was the fact checker there was my girlfriend. And so we had a rent-controlled apartment that she had gotten at 83rd Street in Central Park West.
Oh, wow.
And we threw parties, and people came, and it was a gas. I mean, it was so much fun. And I met big-time writers.
Bo found his passion for writing by rubbing elbows with New York's best writers. He was working hard, perfecting his craft, when he realized that something had to change.
I just came to the end of the string in New York. The actual event that precipitated it was I'd been living up there for more than 4 years, and I don't remember why I was out, but I was over on the east side in the 50s somewhere on Madison Avenue, and I had to make a phone call. I was kind of disgruntled, you know. I was becoming jaded. New York did not fascinate me the way it had for a good long time. And so there I am, and there were no cell phones then. Every street corner in Midtown, on all four corners, there would be a telephone stalk there with four phones on the pole. And every one of them had a line waiting to use the phone.
Wow.
And I looked around, it probably wasn't a critical call or anything like that. I don't remember who I wanted to call, but in order to make that call from there, I was going to have to stand in line. And I looked around, and I just thought, that's it. And I went back to the apartment. I just looked around. I said, well, I'm out of here. And I packed up what I was going to take with me and loaded the car, and I drove down to Asheville, North Carolina, and then from Asheville on over to Dillsboro. And I stayed there for 4 years.
Wow.
And during that time, you know, I was doing nothing but writing. And I'd walk in the late afternoon. It was a wonderful existence.
Bo found growth and peace in the mountains, but he also found out what he was missing in his life. Children. So he found a woman who also wanted kids, and they decided to embark on that journey together.
I met her first in Myrtle Beach. One summer, when she was engaged to a roustabout that she wound up marrying and divorcing.
Where did you meet her? On the beach?
We were a half a block from the beach at a beach house that some guys were renting, and I thought she was one of the strangest beauties I'd ever seen. She was near 6 feet tall and had hair down to her waist and natural blonde.
Your kids must be very tall.
They are. My younger boy is 6'6".
Dang.
Going on 7, and my younger son is, or my oldest boy, is 6'4", 6'5". You know, I used to be a little taller than I am now. I've shrunk.
You're still tall.
Yeah.
So she was beautiful and beautiful.
Oh,
crazy.
Yeah. I remarked it at the time, and I was told a girlfriend of hers was somebody I was dating at the time. And I asked Donna, I said, what's the story on her? She said, oh, that's Betsy. She's this and that, and you know, and she's going to marry Cliff. And that was just, I just met her. And I hadn't seen her in years. And she was still gorgeous, and she'd just come back from California. She filled out, but she was built like a Viking. She's built kind of like you, strong. By that time, I had this epiphany that I wanted to have children. And, I mean, it was like determining that I wanted to write. It was like determining that I wanted to play poker. It was like it was something I was going to do. The first thing I decided was romance this time around is not necessary. Mm. What I'm looking for is somebody that wants to have children. And so that was the deciding factor. And I had a brief liaison with Betsy. She came to live in the mountains for several months, not long. She wanted to get married and have children, and I didn't have a good instinct about it at the time. So I turned that down, and so she left and went on back to Charlotte. It was a year or more later that I decided I wanted to have children. And so I called her up. I said, you still want to have babies? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, I said, I'm getting ready. I had this experience, you know, I used to go hiking by myself up in the mountains. And one morning out there, I was watching this stream, this branch run downhill, thinking about where the water was going, and it was going back to the ocean. And I didn't know what to do with myself. I'd been in the mountains 4 years. I still had a lot to learn as a writer, but something had to change. I was tired of not having a level place to stand on. In the mountains, there's no level place. You know, you're always up this way or that. So I decided I was going to leave the mountains and go back to the coast and get me another boat. In the process of doing that, I was going to find somebody that wanted to have children, and I was going to start having children. And we were going to live on a boat, and travel on a boat, and I was going to have one baby. It was all I thought I needed was one. And so I called Betsy, and I told her what I was up to, that I was on my way to the Outer Banks, like the next day, to go looking for a home on the water and a boat. I was 36 years old.
Okay.
And Betsy was 5 years younger than me. She was 32. I put it to her just that way. I said, "You want to come with me and get the sailboat, and we'll get it underway and go to the JP and do the deal, and let's have us a baby." And she said, all right. So we shook on it. We actually shook on it.
Oh, you know? Wow. Did you have any romantic feelings toward her at all? Or
I had
her, at least physically, or something?
But she, you're talking about a tough cookie now. She was nobody's baby, and she took care of herself. She knew what she wanted. She wanted children, and I did too. And she loved the idea of living on a postcard on a sailboat. I asked her, she said, when are you leaving to do this? I said, as soon as I find a boat. She said, well, how much time can you give me? I said, well, go ahead and get ready now because it ain't going to be long. I know what I'm looking for. So she came that weekend and met me over on the Outer Banks and climbed in the SUV. And we went riding around and got to Beaufort, North Carolina. And there sitting in the inner harbor at Beaufort was exactly the boat that I was looking for. So I took Betsy back to the airport, and I drove back to the cabin in North Carolina. The phone was still connected, and I called up. I put my New York apartment on the market. I put the house in the mountains on the market. And I found a boat, a Hans Christian 38T, they were called, 46 feet long overall, but 38 feet on deck. There was a fella had one in, on an inland lake in Austin, Texas. And the yacht broker said, he said, you won't believe it. He said the floorboards on this boat aren't even scratched. So I climbed on a jet and went out there. And sure enough, I mean, the cellophane was still on the cushions.
Nice.
And their teak and holly floors weren't even scratched. And so,
so
I bought,
you bought
the boat.
I bought the boat.
I called up Betsy. I didn't take delivery on the boat. I bought it in place and left it there. Called up Betsy. And I said, all right. I said, if you're going, drop the lines and let's go.
Yeah.
And so less than 10 days later, she was in the truck, and we were headed back out to Texas.
Oh, wow.
All the girls want to go until it comes time to drop the lines, climb aboard, and go, because it's just a different deal.
Right.
when it's real, and, you know.
You live on the boat then for a while?
Yeah, we lived on the boat for going on 2 years.
And how long did it take till she got pregnant with your first child?
Well, it took about 8 months before she muscled me into going ahead and getting the marriage license. she had to convince me that we needed the license, right? I just wanted the baby.
Yeah.
But she said, no, she said, I ain't doing that. So I said, all right, well, let's go get it done. So
do you feel like she loved you enough? I mean,
Neither one of us.
Or was it
wasn't about romance.
It was transactional.
We talked it out, and we decided we were going to have a partnership, and we were going to respect each other, and we weren't going to depend on some notion of having found a soulmate or, you know,
right.
We're going to be swept away by romance. What we're doing here is we're going to have a child, and we're going to go adventuring together.
Tell me about the day your son was born.
Man, that was something. I didn't know whether he'd live or die. His head was as big as a softball. He weighed 12 pounds, 8 ounces.
Oh.
He was the biggest baby ever born in the Wolfson Mothers and Infants Institute in Jacksonville, Florida. He broke all the records.
Man.
And his face was blue. And his first breath was ragged. Like that. And I looked up at him. They took him to cesarean. They let me in the room, Betsy. And so she's kind of out of it, you know. And I looked up at Buster, at that little baby, and I thought, he might not make it. And so all of my concern turned to Betsy. And I asked the doctor, I said, is she okay? And he said, yeah, she's all right. She's fine. And so they had to resuscitate my first son 5 times.
Oh, wow.
I was there. They let me in the room with him when they had him breathing good. But I was sitting there watching him when, as far as I knew, it was the first time he'd really opened his eyes. But he opened his eyes like that. And, of course, he couldn't see anything, I guess. All blurred, a blur to him. But he opened his eyes. And I mean, you know, he's a big old baby.
Like a toddler.
And his foot twitched. And when his foot twitched, his eyes got big like that. Like, Jesus, I didn't know what I didn't know I was all that. You know, his foot twitched and his eyes got big. And the first thing I thought was, he's already everything he's ever going to be is right there.
Wow.
Right there. And I started crying.
Oh, wow.
And I'll start crying again. You give me a minute. But yeah, that was one of the most powerful things I'd ever seen in my life, was him realizing that he had a body. I used to tell him that story every birthday.
How old is he now?
He's 36. And just he is a gunslinger of a lawyer. He's a good lawyer. He's a white knight. He takes on the big guys for the little guys.
Two more kids came.
Yeah.
Yeah. In how many years?
Four. And three kids in 4 years.
Three kids in 4 years. And how was your relationship with their mom during the childbearing years?
It was good during the childbearing years. I mean, it was as good as it could be it's hard to describe. I mean, we moved off of the boat, and that was the turning point in our relationship. She no longer had to depend on me for anything. We moved into a big old house on Ladies Island outside of Beaufort, South Carolina. And the sailboat's anchored out in front of it in the Morgan River. And we just commenced to, we were like a pair of rabid squirrels in a shoebox. I've used that term before, but she and I together on that boat, we were a team. And she respected what I did, and I respected what she did. Because, buddy, that chick did not back up for a second. She could hardly swim, and she went into deep water with me.
Betsy and Beau's relationship had brought the most wonderful gifts into their lives, their children. But conflict had arisen in their marriage, so they parted ways amicably. Beau kept custody of their children, and then she passed away. Beau was a single father. What did you learn as a single father? I know there's a whole book, but just give me a few highlights.
I learned how brave women are, for one thing. I mean, I hunted bear. I've hunted wild hogs with a knife. I've done some few dangerous things, but I ain't ever been in the valley of the shadow for 9 months running, which is where a woman is. And she knows it, whether she understands it, knows it consciously, or not. That was the thing that I realized was that caring for young children is a life or death circumstance. And I learned it out on the beach, again, holding my younger son, and Buster was 2 years older, and he's toddling, and I'm out there on the beach in the middle of the day, and there were me and 15 or 18 young mothers out there, and we've all got young kids, and we're all standing there, you know, and we're kind of talking out of the sides of our mouths, yeah, where are you from? And we're all watching the kids on the ground. We're just, all of us, well, we're not watching each other, really. We look up maybe, your eyes went straight back to that kid. And I'm standing there doing that. And I noticed we were all doing it. And it just came on like somebody turning on a light in a dark room. I thought, we're doing this because this is a bear hunt we're on here. And what we're trying, a bear's invisible. You can't see that son of a, you can't see him. But he's here. And we're all watching these kids to make sure he doesn't jump on mine. Because all they got to do is pick up a shell and put it in their mouth, you know, and say, oh, that tastes good, and start to swallow it, and it cuts their throat, or, you know, they get stuck, and they can't breathe. And within a matter of minutes, he can be gone.
And
I saw
creature.
That as crystal clear as it could be. And I looked around at those other parents standing there doing the same thing I was doing. And I just thought, wow, this is adventure. I mean, this is the real deal here.
Wow.
This ain't offshore sailing where, you know, you got a pretty good idea you're going to make it back or you wouldn't sail out. But here, this is the zone here we're in with these young kids. And I just, from then on, I really took to it. I had the biggest adventure of my life was raising those kids.
How would your kids describe you as a dad?
I don't know. You know, I think, you know, they love me. They take care of me now. They make fun of me. They tease me, and I tease them right back. Well, sometimes, but they're protective, you know, and they're also you know, I mean, they. One of them the other night, I was just licking the butter off of a butter knife, and my son grabbed my. Don't do that, Daddy. You know, I mean, they treat me like a child to some extent.
Because they love you.
Yeah.
Throughout his life, Beau never stopped writing. But now with his children grown, writing is his main focus. He's written books, short stories, poems, and he has a website highlighting his work.
My writing is very distinctive. I have a unique voice.
Mm-hmm.
And people who read it, almost everybody likes what I write. Some people can't read much of it at a time because, you know, my voice is unique. And when you have that, it takes a while for readers to get on to it, right? But what I do is more like it's prose poetry is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get into the rhythm of it, if I've done my job, you're carried along like you're riding an inner tube in a free-flowing river. And if you don't understand the meanings of the words, just keep right on going because you will, as time goes on, understand what those words mean. You don't. If I've done it right, the phonetics, the sound of the words conveys their meaning.
In the years you have left, you've kind of already laid out what your goals are.
Yeah.
You want to get some of that work published. You still want your shot at fame?
Well, the real irony is that it doesn't mean very much to me.
Or right.
It doesn't mean anything now.
Right.
I mean, I think about it sometimes and I think, yeah, it'd be all right. I mean, I'd get money. I'd be able to give some money to my kids.
Yeah.
Because I spent all the money they gave me.
Yeah.
See, I gnawed that silver spoon right down to a nub. So I'm in here trying to get paid, and I don't make any two ways about it.
Right.
And so, you know,
but you still have...
if you don't quit, yeah. You're not beat.
Right.
And I ain't going to quit. I mean, that ain't happening.
No.
So we'll see. You know, becoming poet laureate. Of Myrtle Beach.
Which happened at the beginning of 2024, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Right then, yeah. Being the poet laureate of Myrtle Beach is potentially a platform from which editors and agents might be willing to fashion a story that could sell like wildfire. I mean, what the city has in mind, as far as I can tell, it elevates the cultural profile of this town to have a poet laureate.
Correct. Yeah.
If you put that in the brochure, they think, well, these guys aren't rednecks completely.
Right.
You know, they've got a poet laureate by name.
We've got some art and culture,
you know,
here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, there's that.
Yeah.
And then, Myrtle Beach is in the early stages of implementing, not planning, but implementing a plan to, in effect, build a new town, as it was in the beginning. My granddaddy built the first new town, and that became Myrtle Beach, and now a part of Myrtle Beach that needs revitalization and rebuilding is going to become a new town at the beach, and it is going to be spectacular.
Beau's life is unconventional. He had many periods where he did not know who he was, what he wanted, or if he was good enough. But now he knows. He's a father and a writer. And the fear that he didn't make his father proud is at rest. He's doing what his daddy did, building Myrtle Beach into something better. But he's doing it his own way.
If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.